And welcome to a special presentation called Film and the Criminal Justice System. And we're going to have a 25-minute presentation from each of our filmmakers here, John Kalina and Alan Zweig, from their respective documentaries. And then we'll have a question period following each of their presentations of 10 to 15 minutes, just so we can concentrate on each of their presentations separately. We'll begin with John Kalina, and he's a broadcast journalist, writer, and director. In English, he's hosted both radio and TV shows at CBC. He's worked as a journalist for The Journal and Le Point. For the last 15 years, he has written and directed numerous documentaries in English and French for broadcasters around the world. He's going to be talking about a two-part film presented on CBC's Witness back in 2003 called To Kill or To Cure. The first part is called Strike Hard and looks at tough justice approaches. And the second, Gentle Justice, examines alternative approaches. Here's John Kalina.
Okay. I guess I shall do it from up here. Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay. Thank you very much, Patty. Indeed, the film is called To Kill or To Cure, and I thought I would start, since I worked so hard in trying to make an opening for this film, that I would let the opening of the film play for itself, and then I would talk about it.
Fire!
This is classic tough justice, meted out as it's been for centuries, and still is in much of the world today. Though some countries have found less lethal ways to dispense it. From corporal punishment to a lifetime alone behind bars. Yet there is another side of justice that seeks to change criminal behavior rather than crush it. An idea that flourishes in Europe and is spreading to North America. Here in Canada, we are pulled in both directions. Fight tough new ideas about prisons filtering across our southern border, and softer ideas from across the sea. But which voices should we listen to?
The chain gangs. They're great. I put them right on the main drag.
Make this law as simple as you can. Three strikes and you're out. And if they can't count to three, we got a problem.
In Japanese prison, discipline and order is the most important thing in prison life. Good behavior in prison is maybe good behavior in community.
People have this preconception that murderers are monsters, that they're people without a face. Well, this is a face. And this is the face of a murderer.
Isn't that the story everywhere you go in Canada? Soft on crime. I mean, soft on crime. What's the deterrent?
Which way will Canada go? Which way should we go? At its root, the choice is always the same: to punish offenders severely, or to try to integrate them back into the community. To take revenge, or to rehabilitate. To kill, or to cure.
All right, well, that is the introduction, and I thought, should I introduce it and then introduce it that way? But it seems to me, on top of it, it's my own voice. So the project started. This is a film that was done in 2003. My colleague and friend Josh Fried and I did this. It was our idea. We co-directed it. We co-wrote it. We actually traveled together around the world for a month and filmed it together. We managed to remain friends by some mysterious way. And to go to back to the genesis of the idea really is a fascination that we both had with the ideas of justice and the fact that the systems around the world seem to be so different. And we were looking for a way to explore that. Now, the CBC at the time, in its witness series, said, that's fine, we really like the idea, we'll give you 2 hours. We'll give you 2 television hours to do this. So we immediately thought, okay, 2 hours, 2 ways, 2 approaches. I imagine if they had given us 5 hours, we would have come up with 5 different ways of parsing this subject, but we had 2. And it did seem to fit neatly into this idea of a tough approach to justice, and a more alternative approach to justice. And we went, in the end, to a number of different countries that, to us, represented, in some ways, these different approaches. And being Canadian, as is reflected in the introduction there, we thought, okay, we are legitimately seem to be in the middle of this. We always compare ourselves to the States, because the States is right next door, so we feel that we have this sort of milder justice system. But when you start comparing it with some other countries in Europe or even Japan, we have a much tougher system than we think. And it seemed to us, and I don't think it was extraordinarily prescient to have had this idea at the time, that this is something that's going to keep on coming up in Canada, and that we are going to be confronting people who, even at that time, would call for a much tougher approach to justice, a tough on crime justice, and of course it's proven to be correct. And we should really explore. And the perspective that I think we tried to bring to it, at least in our own discussions and I hope in the film, was the perspective of what approach to crime would make you safer. There you are walking down the street in a Canadian town or city or in the countryside. What's going to make you a safer person? Is it going to come out of tough prisons, or is it going to come out of some other approach to it? So that's really the perspective. So the first part, the first 1 hour of the film, was called Strike Hard, and we took that from China. Because the Chinese, who to us represented really capital punishment. I mean, they're the world's, you know, greatest executioners. They execute more people than everybody in the world put together. And periodically would have these campaigns, which they called Strike Hard, which would come and sweep through the cities and sweep through the countryside and round up a lot of criminals. And it was a very, very swift justice. They love to say that it's the philosophy, we go back to a Chinese saying, which was, kill the chicken, scare the monkey. And kill the chicken, scare the monkey basically means you're not going to find the smartest criminals this way, you're not going to eliminate all of those people, but you're going to scare the smart criminals, you're going to scare the monkeys, kill enough chickens, you'll scare the monkeys. And in that Strike Hard campaigns, they would actually round up people, try them, and execute them sometimes within a matter of weeks. So a very tough approach to justice. We went to Arizona. You saw a little bit of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's still there in Maricopa County, still telling us that he's the toughest sheriff in America, still enormously popular. And I believe commented recently on the Canadian bill and said, you guys are finally getting it straight. So here's a guy who put people in chain gangs, which we saw in that little clip, who had the criminals in tents, wearing striped clothing, eating bologna, very proudly told me he spent more money feeding the dogs than he did on feeding his prisoners. That was another approach. But the clip that I'm going to show you now was, to me, the most striking thing about what we saw in the United States. Because the United States, if it epitomized one thing, it epitomized the approach of imprisonment. The United States, if China executes more people than anybody else, the United States imprisons more people than anybody else in sheer numbers, in rate of incarceration, etc. I mean, it's the prison capital of the world. And the prison that's the most striking prison in this American context is the Supermax prison, the prison within a prison. And we were allowed, and it's one of those fascinating things about the United States, is once you go through enough hoops as a journalist or as a filmmaker and you ask enough times, or if you go through the correct hoops, they let you in. And not only do they let you in, they let you do anything you want. They really literally said, you can speak to anybody. You can film anything, and you can speak to anybody as long as they sign a release. So, as opposed to our own country, where it took much longer to get much less access. So, here is a little excerpt from the Pelican Bay clip. And let's go here.
Harsh punishment has a long history in the West. And while it's become less brutal, we still haven't entirely escaped it. Even in the world's most advanced country. This is Pelican Bay, an American supermax prison on a remote part of California's coastline. It's as tough as prison gets in a country which has decided the only answer to crime is to lock people up. There are 2 million prisoners in America, a country that has now become the world's largest jailer. And the people here are said to be the worst of the worst. It's a shadow world, out of sight and out of mind from the rest of the country. Prisoners here are kept in their cells 23 hours a day, alone. Some will spend their whole lives in a small chamber where they never see the sun. It's today's Alcatraz, a high-tech system with armed guards at a central control who watch every prisoner's movement every moment of the day. Prisoners don't even have eye contact with each other. To communicate, they shout from cell to cell. They even play chess this way. By law, everyone must be allowed out of their cell 1 hour a day for exercise. But even this is done indoors and alone. Most of these men are violent offenders, serving life sentences. The warden says that part of the reason they're shut away is to protect them from each other.
Many of the individuals we have here are very sophisticated. Perfectly working handcuff can be slipped by some of these individuals. So all of a sudden you have a person that you thought you had restrained and they're no longer in restraints and able to act against officers or other inmates.
This man's been here 22 years and calls himself Double Life Godzilla because he's serving 2 life terms for murders he committed in jail.
I killed one of my cellies in New Folsom. And then 2 guys ran in my cell in this prison, and one went out brain dead 2 days on a life support machine. I killed both of them without weapons, from bare hands.
There are constant searches for dangerous weapons, the only time most prisoners are in human company. Many here have the same fear.
Losing touch with reality. Losing touch with being a human being. I don't want to make it seem like I'm having psychological problems, but there's always that constant fear that that is going to come after being here for so long. Everything you do is through these doors, through these little holes. And you'll notice after we talk for a little while, your vision will start getting distorted. When you're looking at me, it'll look like you got on some of those old 3D glasses or something. And this is how we spend our days. This is, you know, so you can imagine after 10, 15, 20 years of this, 5 years of this, I suppose, what it would do to one's mind.
Those who study supermaxes say they're a form of psychological torture.
Some of them go mad. I've seen people in supermax confinement banging their heads against the wall, mutilating themselves, smearing themselves with feces. Babbling incoherently, screaming, some of them lying in catatonic positions on the floor of their cells. This certainly doesn't happen to everyone, but it happens to an unsettlingly high number of people who get placed in these kinds of environments.
So imagine a man sitting in a cage this size for 16 years. We're a people, as human beings, who can fly people to the moon. We're a people, as human beings, who can write the most beautiful poetry, the most beautiful poems. As human beings, we're so advanced. But we can't find a better way to get people to assimilate into society and to act correctly according to the laws than to throw them in cages and forget about them. I mean, it doesn't say much for who we are.
I think they're too comfortable. Here they get to go to the inmate store once a month and spend $45 for candy and cookies and personal toiletry items. They also have 24-hour cable TV in their cell. They get visits. I personally would like to see them have to earn those things by showing that we're on our way to something better.
Well, that was Pelican Bay, which I have to say was one of the stronger environments I found myself in a year of spending time in prison. A tough place. But, you know, we wanted to quite legitimately bring the discussion, as our central theme was, to also to look about our own country. Now, this is 2003. The Liberals are in power federally. But you didn't have to look that far to find fairly tough on crime rhetoric in Canada. The Reform Party in Alberta, many of whom we still see today, and the Mike Harris government in Ontario, which was following its own quite tough on crime agenda. So here's a little clip about Canadian hard justice. And I'm beginning to realize what happens when I do this. It takes a little time to warm up for some reason. So bear with a moment of some little hesitation here.
Tough justice instinctively appeals to many people, although there's no hard evidence that it works. In fact, statistics show that whatever the justice system, crime is falling all over the Western world. Nevertheless, harsh punishment is on the rise all over the U.S. The campaign is even spilling into gentle Canada. Canadians already have a pretty tough justice system, although very few of us get a chance to peek inside. This is Kingston Pen, Canada's oldest penitentiary. Today, Kingston is still a federal maximum security prison for some of the worst of Canada's 31,000 prisoners. Inmates live better lives than they did in these same cells 150 years ago. But the amount of time they spend here is getting longer as Canada comes under the influence of U.S. justice. Prisoners here are serving what Canadian officials say are some of the longest sentences in the Western world.
There are European countries that regard long-term sentences as 4 years or more. Well, gosh, you know, for some crimes in Canada, you're hardly getting warmed up with a sentence of 4 years. People convicted of first-degree murder in this country serve on average twice as long before release as other Western nations. 28 years in custody before release versus around 14 years.
We are especially tough on youth in Canada. 24,000 are in detention,
most of them for property crimes, the second highest per capita rate in the Western world, according to legal experts.
If you compare the incarceration rates of kids in Canada and the United States, for property offenses, we incarcerate more than the United States does. For violent offenses, it's about the same. But for property offenses, we seem to have a love for locking up kids.
It's still not tough enough for many people. A growing number of Canadian politicians and police groups are pushing for harsher U.S.-style sentencing here. They're led by the province of Ontario, which is modeling all its new prisons after America's recent no-frills ones. Welcome to Maplehurst Super Jail, just outside of Toronto, the largest correctional facility in Canada. There are no guard towers, just bland structures that resemble an industrial park, with lots of security. Like all new Ontario facilities, there's a U.S.-style pod system that isolates prisoners in small, Spartan cell blocks. There are no TVs, radios, or computers allowed. All things you'd find in a federal prison. Prisoners are rarely allowed outside, even to exercise.
Ontario's approach is a no-frills approach, that the time fits the crime. It's not going to be an easy time for them, and it shouldn't be an easy time for them. In many respects, in Canada, we are too soft. I think there's a philosophy at the federal level, and I think it's failed the country.
For all this security, most of these provincial prisoners are petty thieves with short sentences who stay behind bars an average of only 70 days. Ontario is building big, tough jails for small-time criminals. But Runciman says his government is trying to send Ottawa a message. It's time for more punishing Canadian prisons and longer jail sentences. Surveys show that a majority of Canadians support tougher penalties, as well as a return to capital punishment. Yet almost every criminologist you talk to in Canada or elsewhere says that dozens of studies show that tough punishment doesn't deter crime.
If you're saying we want to treat people harshly, take away their color TV, you know, give them bologna sandwiches every day, and therefore our society will be safer, you're on thin ice. There's nothing to support that. But if that's your ideological position, that holding people to account by treating them very harshly is the way you want to go, by all means do it.
All right, I don't want to go much over time here. I've got two more little clips to present to you, nothing quite as long. I'd like to get to the other approach. So that was, just for your information, Robert Runciman, who was the Solicitor General, the Attorney General at the time in Ontario, I believe is in the Senate at the moment. So people haven't slipped away so completely. We wanted to do, in our second film, which was called Gentle Justice, we wanted to have a different approach. And the one I'm going to show you now is, I think, the most different approach than we've seen. And if we have time, I'll go to the fifth one, but if not, I'll just sort of conclude from there. But this is, I think, worth... We went to Finland. It was an eye-opener for us.
This man belongs to an odd club, found only here in Helsinki, Finland. People who've paid the world's most expensive speeding tickets. His name is Keo Kopra, and his last ticket cost about $50,000 US, for going 25 kilometers an hour over the speed limit. And it wasn't even his first offense.
I've had three tickets so far, for about $100,000 US. My wife couldn't believe the last one. Even the police were sympathetic. But in the end, they decided the law is the law.
Finnish law says that a rich man must feel the sting of justice as much as a poor one, so traffic fines go up with your income. Keo is well off, so he pays a lot. But if he were poorer, he'd only pay $100 for the same offense. Huge traffic fines aren't the only strange ideas about justice coming out of this Nordic country. It's a world leader in keeping people out of jail. This policy reflects the spirit of the Finns, a humane society that reinvented its justice system. Until the 1960s, Finland had one of Europe's highest imprisonment rates. But then they cut their prison sentences and turned to rehabilitation. The reason is simple, says the head of the prison system.
Every prisoner in Finland comes back to society. But then we have to ask how he comes back. A serial killer or more human person.
Today, Finland has one of the world's lowest imprisonment rates and one of the most revolutionary approaches to crime. Expensive fines play a big role, and not just for bad drivers. Over half of those convicted of crimes pay fines instead of serving time, including con men and first-time burglars. Those charged with assault are hit with fines of about $3,000, and even more if they're rich, say Finnish criminologists.
Fines can be used as an alternative to prison sentences if you use fines that are heavy enough, fines which grasp your wallet. I don't think you can dispute on the basic principle that for a richer man, the fine must be bigger than for a poorer man for the same offense.
All right, I think I don't want to run out of time here. We went on and, I mean, it was, it was an interesting process to go through for us as filmmakers, as journalists being in Finland because, you know, the first time people say, well, you just give people fines and the fines are based on how much money you make. It's not just a regular fine. It just seems like a crazy idea. And then you realize, well, you know, if you're very wealthy and somebody gives you a $100 fine, it's really not very much. But if they start to give you $25,000 fine for speeding, yeah, you know, you stop speeding. And we went to various prisons there, and the prisons are quite nice. There's a scene that I was going to show you, but which, you know, prisoners are getting massages. There are saunas because it's Finland and in prisons, etc. And if you speak to them about it and you say, well, why are you making this so nice? It's so completely the opposite take on making prisons really bad. They say, well, as the head of the prison system said to us, well, you have to think about what they're going to be like when they get out. So do you want them to get out feeling really angry and at society and having been brutalized and be more brutal? Or do you want them to get out and having learned something about themselves and feeling better about themselves? And there was a young woman, I was looking at the film just the other day, and, you know, she was there and they let you have your baby, if you have a baby, in there with you. And she said, you know, it saved my life. Now, I don't think you find many people in the prison system in Canada or in the U.S. who would say that that prison has saved their life. In this sort of alternate general justice part of our project, we also went to Japan, which is very harsh prisons, but very short sentences. And we ended up speaking to the highest-ranking criminal justice officer in Japan. And oddly enough, he said very similar thing to us, which I think epitomizes this alternative approach. He said, we don't think prisons are good. We don't think prisons are good for you. We don't like what prisons do for people. So we really try to keep people out of prison. It's almost impossible in Japan to go to prison for a first offense. I mean, they really don't want to put you in jail. The police officer who meets you will almost inevitably not arrest you, will try to sort of see what's going on, speak to parents if it's a young person, etc. Then you get brought to the station. Then they don't want to charge you. Then if they charge you, they don't want to put you on trial. If they put you on trial, you go to jail. But it's very rare for a first offense. Now, mind you, a second offense, you've just now proven that you are a criminal person. So there are these different approaches. And I guess I would say, just in conclusion, of having spent a couple of years of my life looking at this myself, is it's very hard to be convinced of any of the rhetoric of the tough on crime. When you speak to people, when you speak to people who run prisons, you speak to people who've done research on it, nobody seems to be able to tell you that any of the stuff, any of the harsh conditions, any of these harsher sentences, etc., deter people. The woman, Mary, I think her name was, I can't remember her name quite, who was in the prison system there, said to me, wasn't in the film, but I never forgot it. She said, deterrence. She said, as far as we can see, that the average time for contemplating and premeditating a crime in Canada is 15 minutes. Well, you know, in those 15 minutes with people who are either drunk or stoned, they're not actually saying, do you realize how bad the food is? Do you realize that you can't have a computer in there? They don't do it. They say, look at that gas station. Let's go, you know, let's go knock off the gas station. So I must say, I myself came out of this process thinking prisons are not good for people and harsh punishments do not seem to deter crime. And it's very hard to make that case. And anyway, that was To Kill or To Cure, the mini version.
We'll have 10 minutes or so of questions here, but John, I want to ask you, what effect did this film have on public discourse at the time? Was there any?
Well, you know, interestingly, it was in 2003. I don't think it had a huge effect on public discourse, but since then, it has been seen by a lot of people. It's been seen by a lot of judges, and apparently it seems to have affected people in that level. I'm very glad that, you know, the French talk about diffuser les films, you know, and it always seemed to me that that was what my work went. It was like now playing in Pluto somewhere, you know, in some distant place. But these days it lives on in DVDs, it lives on in different things. So I think it had, you know, some little effect on a few people. Clearly what's happened, you know, 8 years later is the very people who were talking about tough justice in Canada in 2003 are in power, and we see the crime bill that we have. So it's really come to pass.
And also, what does that sort of say about journalism like this that has a kind of advocacy element to it, that it's not heard, that it doesn't have a kind of power about it?
Yeah, well, I guess I've just been doing it a little bit too long to think that it has an enormous amount of power, but indeed, it's discouraging if you think that what your film is going to do is change the way everybody thinks or the nature of your society. It's discouraging. I think you make small changes. You affect some people, we hope. But no, we certainly didn't do it. Even the more grandiose productions out of, say, Michael Moore, I don't know how much it changes anything. Did it change the healthcare debate to make Sicko? Probably not.
Any questions from the audience? Why do you think that people, citizens, or I mean, I suppose people who are supporting the omnibus crime bill now, really don't care about the treatment of prisoners? That there's this maliciousness that's built into this punitive framework of thinking about.
Well, I think there's something very natural about punitive justice. I mean, you know, we feel angry towards people who've done things, or we feel we put ourselves in the place of victims, which is one of the reasons that you want to have victims to have a voice, but you don't really want them to necessarily decide on people's sentences, etc. I think there is something quite natural about that. I think we don't admit it often. That's why, you know, someone in the film in the excerpt that we heard, you know, she said, look, if what you're saying is you want to punish people by giving them bad food and bad conditions because they've done something wrong, fine. If you're saying you're doing it to make society safer, then you're on thin ice. I think there's also a sort of pernicious, corruption of what's called common sense. It seems to be common sense. You make punishment's nastier, you make sentences longer, that would deter people from committing crimes. It just doesn't happen to be true. It doesn't seem to be true. But it makes some, once again, it makes some sort of sense.
John, interesting film. I just want to ask you on this gentle approach in Finland, how do they address violent crime there, murders, and do you know if there's been any change in attitude there since the terrible incidents of last year in Finland where there was this mass murder?
I think that was Norway.
No, I'm sorry, Norway, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But has there been any change at all in attitude since you were there? Because I believe you said the film was it
8 years old. You know, the Finns already had changed their ideas. Finland had been under Russian domination for a period of its time, mostly in the 19th century. And at one point, they invited a Norwegian criminologist to come in because they had a very high rate of incarceration, mostly for drunkenness and offenses that stem from being drunk. But they had a lot of people in jail. And he was a very noted criminologist, and he went there and he addressed them and he said, you know, you have a very Russian system. And they were completely offended. They didn't like that. He said, you have a very Russian approach to justice. And it's a small enough country that there was, and this is like in the late 60s, there was a small group of people who were in the criminal justice system there, and they said, you know what, we're going to change this. And we're just going to change it. And they went around and they rewrote the laws, and there was enough respect for authority that people sort of went along in society to do this, a certain amount of grumbling. And they reduced the prison sentences. There were tons of things that you don't go to prison for, that you just pay fines for. And the crime rate never went up. It didn't go down, but it never went up. So it didn't seem to actually matter whether you put all these people in jail or not, or how long you put them in jail. And you know, it's a bold experiment that I don't know if anyone else has done, but you probably could put 1/10 of the percentage of the people in prison that we put in prison and have no appreciable rise in your crime rate. What do they do? They're certainly not fools about this. If you're a violent criminal, you stay in prison much longer than if you're a nonviolent criminal. You know, the odd thing is that there are very few professional violent criminals. I mean, there are a small percentage of crazy people that nobody under any circumstances would ever, you know, let out. There are the Charlie Mansons that are not, you know, they come up for parole. They'll never get out. In this country, we have the faint hope clause that gets people upset. But, you know, people who have committed violent crimes in Finland or Norway or Canada are not going to get out very quickly. But there are a lot of murderers who are, you know, it was a circumstantial thing. And if you let them out 7 years later or 10 years later under supervision, people don't seem to reoffend. I think if there are criminologists in the room, I believe it's one of the lowest level of reoffenses for some of those crimes. I mean, if you're a crazy, violent person, yes, they don't let you out either. And you get to take a sauna. I think it was a useless and from my own personal opinion, as long as you ask, I think it was a destructive and useless idea in the States, and that's occasionally gets re-examined. I think it's being re-examined at times now. It's a bit like the three strikes and you're out sort of approach in California, which is the reason there are so many prisoners in California, which they're just now trying to get those numbers down. It makes sense in a certain way. You have a war on drugs. You have a war on cancer. You have a war on this. You have a war on drug. You have a drug czar. You have, you know, part of it is an American approach to things, a very militarist, at least metaphorically military approach to things, and not so metaphorical. Doesn't seem to have worked very well. And it put a lot of people in prison. In that California prison with the three strikes, we interviewed the person whose daughter had been murdered, who was the author of the three strikes law. And I truly believe that most people in California who voted for three strikes and you're out thought that they were saying, look, if you commit three violent crimes, we're going to put you away for 25 years to life. But in the end, it just meant three serious crimes. And there are 110 odd serious crimes in California, including burglary without a weapon. So that's where you get the third crime often being, you know, famously being stealing pizza or, you know, a pair of pants out of a store, etc. I don't think these things, from anybody who I ever talked to about it, I have not seen anybody who said, this really works. So whether it's three strikes or the war on drugs or mandatory minimums, or it doesn't seem, but it doesn't seem to bother people that it doesn't work, so who advocate it.
I had a question. Is it too late?
Okay, no, last one.
No, great, thank you. My name is Lena Palacios. I'm a student here. And, yeah, I did grow up in California, in Oakland, San Francisco, and I did visit Pelican Bay quite a number of times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite an institution. So thank you for at least revealing what's happening behind behind bars in Pelican Bay with the security housing unit. I guess the question I have is that back in 1995, Mike Davis coined in a Nation article, he was the first one to coin the prison industrial complex as
right.
a term. And this is right again following on the heels of the 1994 passage of the Three Strikes Amendment or Proposition 21. I guess my question to you is that I would love, there's not been a lot of economic analysis about who really profits from prisons. And I think that Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who's a critical race feminist and a geographer, wrote one of the most stringent critiques of California called it's called Golden Gulag. I would love to see that same kind of analysis here in Canada in terms of really charting who, what politicians, what corporations are actually profiting from this kind of hyper-incarceration, which we will definitely see now following the passage of the Omnibus Crime Bill. So I guess my question to you is that, do you have any plans for the future for doing that kind of work? Or is somebody, you know, I'd love to see a next film, but if you can maybe answer or talk
well,
a little bit about those issues.
You know, it's a huge topic, this topic, and we certainly were interested in this sort of the privatization, but it just became too big a thing. I did notice today when I was looking at where some of the people were who I was filming, and Robert Runciman, who was in the Senate, when he was in some of his various positions in Ontario, he was advocating private prisons, and I believe they were starting to be built. I haven't really followed it, but I think we've started to have it there. And indeed, once you have, it's enough just to have enough prisons. If you go to upstate New York, it's one of the biggest employers in Michigan and a number of places. And the prison guard union becomes an advocate in the world of sentencing and of you know some of the legal arguments. And it's clearly, it's not even a conflict of interest, it's in their interest to do this. So even in a public system, it employs enough people, it builds enough buildings, and even just the logic, the psychological, the logic of having the buildings means you want to fill the buildings. You want to give the people who are working there things to do. You want to fill the buildings. You want to, nobody wants to be soft on crime. Nobody wants to be bad on unemployment, etc. Then, on top of it, once you have it once you privatize it, it's a whole nother kettle of fish. And indeed, there are terrible, terrible stories on that one. You know, use of prisoners as cheap labor, you know, just profit, sheer profit on the whole thing. It's not, frankly, a film I would like to do. I would like, you could do this film. I'd be happy to look at the rough cut and give you my opinion.
Thanks a lot, John.
You're very welcome.
Our next presenter is Alan Zweig, who has been working in the film business for more than 25 years, screenwriting, acting, teaching, and directing. In 2000, he completed Vinyl, his first documentary, concerned with obsessive record collectors, one of whom is in this room. That premiered at Hot Docs. He followed that up with two more documentaries, Carmageddon, where he examined the risks of being a naysayer in a society continually pitching the positive, and Lovable in 2007, where he explored yearnings for the romantic myths of our culture. He moved on to less personal territory with A Hard Name, which explores the lives of ex-convicts. And this film went on to win a Genie for Best Feature-Length Documentary for 2009.
Hi, thanks. A few days after I was invited to this conference, I saw a piece on TV about an effort by police to separate prostitutes from their pimps. One of the girls told a particularly disturbing story of being brutalized by her pimp when she was 15. The story had an immediate effect on me. I wanted to find the guy and do to him what he did to this young girl. The strength of my emotions surprised me. I wanted revenge, quick and brutal. I'm not sure what it was about this story and this day that affected me like that. It was an unusually cruel act, so that was probably part of it. And I'm sure someone would suggest it has something to do with having a daughter. I'm still getting used to having a daughter, and my emotions are definitely a bit frayed. The show gave the strong impression that prostitutes are coerced into the life more often than I had previously thought, so perhaps that's believable. A few days earlier, I had looked at the invitation, seen the phrase, the future of justice, and reacted almost scoffingly to that last word. We don't have justice, I thought to myself. All we have is punishment and revenge. I may have always thought that to some degree, but I probably feel it a bit more deeply, having spent some time around ex-cons. Some of the characters in my film, A Hard Name, excerpts of which I'll be showing in a few minutes, I met at a Christian support group called the Friends of Dismas, which meets every second Friday night in a church basement in Toronto. And I've continued to attend that group after the film was finished. The biggest challenge for me in attending is not the hanging out with the ex-cons, it's the hanging out with the Christians. But I tolerate it because I feel like I'm supposed to be there. When you hang out with ex-cons in a social setting, you eventually start to worry about them. You want them to succeed. You want them to have some hope, some self-esteem, to start believing in themselves and have more resilience when disappointments arise. You want the world to accept them, love them, and let them move on. You want them to start to feel like the ground they walk on is solid. More than anything, you want them to stay out of jail this time and end that cycle of jail, release, reoffend or break parole, and going back to jail. What you don't generally think about when you hang out with ex-cons is what they did to end up in jail in the first place. And though occasionally victims of crime do show up and address the group, we don't often think about the specific victims of our friends with whom we break bread and with whom some of us sing hymns every second Friday. So I hang around with people who have committed crimes, but I also have moments like I had watching that show, or when I had the other day listening to the testimony in this Tory Stafford case, where I'm confronted with the crimes and their victims. And I understand why revenge and punishment are part of our justice system. I think I also understand why it's so hard for us to consider the humanity of the criminal. Sometimes their crimes seem inhuman. Still, the question remains, when we say the word justice, not here perhaps, but generally, are we talking about justice for everyone, justice in the sense of the term restorative justice, or are we only talking about justice for we, the victims and potential victims, we who did nothing wrong ourselves and can't understand how they could do such horrible things to us, we who need to be protected from them? Of course, I have no authority or expertise with which to address any of those issues. I'm just someone who made a film in which some of these issues are implied. So before I can demonstrate further how little authority I have on the subject, let me move on to talking about the film which got me invited here today. It's a bit of a cliche for filmmakers to say that the film they made was not the one they set out to make, but of all the films I've made, this is the one where it's most accurate. I've never been more surprised by where a film ended up going, not to mention the impact it had on my life. All I set out to do was talk to people who'd spent a lot of time in prison. If I thought at all about what I might hear from them, I imagine I might find out if some of the things I'd seen in movies were true. As a fan of Edward Bunker novels and prison films, I was curious to know about shanks and shivs and the prison code, which I did. But all I really thought was that these are people we don't often hear from, except under very narrow circumstances, and if I gave them a chance to talk, I'd hear things that surprised me. On some level, I would have been satisfied if they just shared recipes, as long as they were revealing themselves. The reason I wasn't sure what we would talk about is because, at least for the purposes of my own film, I never come in with a specific agenda or a list of questions. I get a lot of credit for getting good interviews, but I attribute that to the fact that they're not interviews at all. I would not be good at interviewing live over the air. But I'm not trying to get a good interview in that sense. I'm just trying to get the subjects to be as comfortable as they can be. We have a conversation, and I let it take its own course, confident in my ability and my editor's ability to make something of it. If I got good conversations in this particular film, I think it's because of all the people at whom I've ever pointed a camera. These were the ones who most appreciated my apparent lack of agenda. People say I seem to establish trust quickly. I think trust is too big a word, but I believe they felt some comfort with me. They all claim to have a good bullshit meter. Others say that about them too. I don't know if their meters are finer tuned than anyone else's, but if their meters didn't go off with me, I think it was because I wasn't trying to lead them in any particular direction, as others generally do with them. This is all to say, I was entirely unprepared for the place many of our conversations went. And more to the point, I didn't expect that we'd talk about their childhoods as much as we did. I didn't think so many of them would talk about being sexually abused as children. I certainly never asked any of them if they'd been abused, nor would I ever. Even after four of them had admitted to being abused, I was surprised when the fifth one did, and so on. I was surprised partly because of my own naivety, and partly because I didn't expect they would allow themselves to be as vulnerable as they were. With some dismay, I have to tell you, I get the sense that most people who have seen A Hard Name would describe it as a film which attempts to explain or even excuse the criminal life of the characters in the film, and by extension all criminals, by blaming such behavior on the crimes committed against them in childhood. I think many people who love the film might describe it that way, and I'd be willing to bet that most of those who dislike the film would cite that as the main reason for their disapproval. I took pains to not allow the stories of abuse to overwhelm the film, to make it more ambiguous than that, to make it richer and more layered. And I think I could mount a passionate defense against that interpretation, pointing out many examples of how that message is undercut. But though I bristle at the thought that I would make a film that sets out such a simple and unambiguous argument, ultimately I feel it's not so bad if people think that way. It's not so bad if that's all they take away from it, because that's a lot. I've seen audience react as if it's the first time they've thought about the forces that might have gone into creating these criminals. I've seen them grappling with the apparent paradox that such sweet, charming, vulnerable characters that they feel like they're meeting in the film could have once done the things they admit to doing in the film. And many of them have told me that as much as they may have known this intellectually, watching the film was the first time they really thought about the fact that once upon a time, these so-called hardened criminals were innocent little babies, just like the little babies they have at home. I get this from folks like me who hadn't really known many ex-cons, but also, to my surprise, from professionals whose lives intersect with criminals every day. The morning after the film premiered at Hot Dogs in Toronto, I got a call from a friend who worked for the Ontario Attorney General asking me if I could get her tickets to the repeat screening. She told me that after the film premiered, their email and Twitter were filled with reports that this was a film everybody working there had to see. I was gratified to hear this, but I was also in a certain way disappointed. I assumed that people who come into close contact with criminals would have at least occasionally been confronted with the kinds of things that come up in the film. I thought this would be no big deal for them, business as usual. But it seems it isn't. And this has been borne out repeatedly, whether it's been a screening for the anniversary of a halfway house, or for staff at Children's Aid, or anecdotally from a judge who told my friend the other day that the film had circulated among its colleagues. What I hear from people who come into contact with criminals, as well as those who don't, is essentially, we didn't know. And so, as I said, if the only thing anyone's getting from the film is a certain image, like a flashback, which allows them to look at today's hardened criminals and imagine them once as a scared, innocent child, I can't ask for more. There are seven characters in the film, and I see my films as collective stories, but I think it would be more effective if I use my time here to show you one of the characters rather than trying to do a montage of all of them. Gord is the oldest character in the film, the one who did the most time and committed the most serious crimes. There are at least two other characters in the film that people think of as, for lack of a better word, the stars of the film, but I've always considered Gord the heart of the film. For the most part, the people in my film follow what I'm told is a familiar pattern. They go to jail the first time when they're 16 or 17, and they wake up at 45, still children in many ways, wondering what the hell they did with the last 30 years. That goes for Gord, too, except it took him a little longer to wake up. You'll get to meet Gord in a few moments, but just before you do, please let me share one more impression I've gotten from the criminals and ex-cons I've met and hung out with. We're not nearly as frightened of them as they are of us. Of course, they generally act differently than most of us do when we're scared, more like cornered animals than scared bunnies. Which is why I think, even as just a practical matter, at least until we decide to lock up every single criminal for their entire lives and never let them out. While they're among us, it's in our interest to make them feel as safe as we can. And the way I suggest we do that is by accepting them back into the family of man. So I just have two more warnings before I show this. First of all, I didn't want to say this, but now I just had second thoughts. So some of it, it's a little brutal. And then the other thing is, if jump cuts make you nauseous, just close your eyes and listen to the sound. So now, can you show me how to turn? I hope the sound is good. I don't hear it.
When I was young, I went to Kingston Penitentiary when I think I was 19 or 20, something like that. You know, I've been in prison since for the last 40 years. I was involved in a lot of prison politics, drugs, and, you know, just disrupting the good order of the institution. I thrive in prisons. I like maximum security. You know where you stand in a maximum security. When I was in Prince Albert, when this Clifford Olson come in, I stabbed him like 21 times. This is before he ever got out and committed these horrible crimes.
And why did you stab Clifford Olson?
Well, muscling kids. He was muscling a kid. So we beat him with a hammer and stabbed him with a pair of scissors in the gym in Prince Albert. This is the way it goes where I come from. You do that and you get killed. I had 40 days left of my sentence when I end up stabbing that Clifford Olson. And got another 10 years. But I had a reputation. This is the way it is with me, you know. Hardcore, you know, so-called, look what it got. Ask me if I do it now, no. I had to change. I wanted to change. I didn't want to live like this anymore. Having accomplished nothing, being a criminal, like, you know, being incarcerated all my life, I couldn't deal with that type of lifestyle anymore. You know, I created a lot of problems and have a lot of victims. Seriously, I have a seriously bad criminal record, and a lot of people have suffered because of me.
That's the book that you are in.
What page is that on? One night, Olson was bushwhacked during a poker playing session by a half a dozen inmates in the prison recreation. One of them was Gordon Lucy, who received 6 years for his attempt on Olson. If I get the chance, I'd try it again.
Is that literally what you said, or they're making?
Well, that's who I am that way. I live by the prison code. You go out and rape children, and that's what happens. If I was a square, John, I would have sat back and applauded that one nicely. And I think you probably would do.
What was he in prison for that time?
He was in for, I think, robbery or something like that.
So this is years before he was a serial killer, essentially.
Yeah.
How come he didn't die? How come with all those?
Oh.
I mean, that's you guys stabbed him 20 times.
That's why I know we went. You know, like I say, I'm convicted of it. I can talk. I went back and stabbed him a couple more times right in the kidney, and he still lived, this guy.
This one, hostage freed, three inmates win transfer vow.
That's me, that's me in Quebec.
Okay.
Yeah, here's me here. Let me tell you about this one. I was in Laval. We're up in D Block. There was a bunch of guards, about three. There was a little small click on a certain shift would come by. So what we did, and we went out to the yard, and... the objective was we're going to grab some hostages here because they tortured us up there and put me through fucking hell, okay, and hurt me and, you know, treated me and humiliated me.
So these are the two guards?
Yeah, he's the
one. They were held for 13 hours with ice picks at their throat.
Yeah, we put them through what they put us through. Stripped them off bare naked, tied them to the thing, and we tormented them. How does it feel? And here's a little taste of your own medicine. So one took a heart attack.
Heart attack and died?
No, he pretty near died. They transferred us out at 1 o'clock in the morning in his own personal private jet, Rennie Levesque, with 15 armed RCMP.
So you actually got your demands?
Got my demands.
Where's your name?
Stabbing in the...
Inflicts wounds, self-inflicted. Gordon J. Lucier, 31, is in stable condition in Millhaven. With self-inflicted wounds.
What I did, I just went into my cell, I took a knife and I drove it straight through my stomach. Straight, right to one end to the other. And I just took a straight razor, I pulled a straight razor, I had it up my bum and I took it out and I just slashed all my, everything.
Doesn't it hurt to stab yourself?
I didn't care. Yeah, I mean, I don't
This is. Look at that. Like, you know, that's terrible, isn't it? Look at that. You know, your guts are all. I went through some major surgeries, man.
Anything that you read about me in the newspapers and that, it all happened in a prison setting.
Right.
Am I right?
Right.
I have to survive, man.
You were telling me before about you knew a guy was going to get killed and you didn't warn him and he got killed. Was that driving you crazy that you didn't tell him?
No. So, I didn't, because you, how I looked at it, not my business and mind your own business. I was with him. We smoked a joint. We smoked hash. I had a visit. I scored some dope. And we smoked up that night in my cell. I just said nothing. I should have told him, get out of here. You know, I couldn't say nothing.
So you liked him. That's what it comes down to.
I love him now. I mean, I walk into the pool room and he's being strangled and being stabbed to death. And I'm like that. And I turned around and walked away. I went to my visit. I wasn't even in the visit 5 minutes. All I could hear is bam, bam, bam. The buzzer's going. Lockdown, lockdown. He was dead in the common room and I knew it. That's the one that turned my life around. There was two posts to go that night, and he ended up getting killed. And,
You know what? I mean, can I just pause for a second? Just the way you said, like, that's just the world of prison. Fuck, man. Like, you're saying two supposed to go that night. You're talking about two human beings who are supposed to be killed
that night. That's how I used to think. That's how I lived.
You know,
like, that's part of the game. You that's the way you live, and it's just that's why I said I've got a conscience, and it came back to haunt me. And I used to get dreams where I'd see it vividly. I could just it was just happening in your mind, eh? Just see it all, eh? And I used to I seen that, and I said, man, what's my life? Just everything. And I used to cry in my cell over that, eh? You can't cry in front of other inmates. And that just turned me around. I turned right against the law. I'd get dope. I wouldn't give nobody nothing. I'd stay in my cell and just shoot it all and stay high. I wouldn't talk to nobody. That's at the end. I want out of this. My objective is, good, nobody got hurt. That's the big. I didn't care about the psychological effects of anything. Nobody got killed. And you're lucky you didn't get fucking killed. I go out, rob a bank, go in, put a gun on the main teller, you know. Give me your fucking money, I'm killing you. And not only that, we got your husband, you know that. Because I'd always make sure that I'd follow them and we'd know where they're living. I got your kid and here's the car you're driving, and here's the license plate number.
You didn't have that.
Oh yeah, I did. Here's your bank, here's your
you
license.
Mean you had
that. I had their license plate number.
No, but you didn't have a Confederate holding your husband.
No.
You told her that.
Yeah. And because it would be believable, because it says here's the license plate number of your car and here's your address. I didn't care about the what do you call it?
Psychological
or physical, whatever they had. As long as they didn't die, that's the main thing. But I learned, did I ever learn the hard way, like, you know, what happened to them? And, when they're on the stand and, you know, the way they're looking at me and this is what my life's been all about.
It is kind of interesting, like, does everybody deserve forgiveness?
Yes. Everybody, but doesn't mean that they should be released from prison.
Forgiveness won't necessarily heal what needs to be healed.
Exactly. And that's what I'm coming to terms with about genuinely forgiving. And I believe I'm on my way there.
And who are you forgiving?
I forgive that the people that inflicted some seriously bad things to me, like raping me and tying me down. Having intercourse with me. My father bringing guys home, raped me, beat me. Sorry.
That's okay. I mean,
just,
you know what? That's,
you know.
That never goes, like, yeah.
Me, I'm naive. I'm 9 years old. I'm being told I'm sleeping in the same, you can sleep in the same bed as you, right? And things were happening to me and cuddling, like, and smothering me and holding me down, like, and going to school and my ass is all blood and, you know, I'm hurting and bleeding. And
so, Alan, having reconciled the humanity with the brutality of going through the process of doing this film, what do you think should be the incarceration process? What should happen?
Well, geez, I don't know. I mean, you know, let me just add one sort of thing that sort of, in a way, ruins any argument that I might make for mercy and prison and all this, is that when I ask ex-cons, if we as society completely got on board the idea of eliminating prison violence, or at least lessening it, could we do it? Ex-cons almost unanimously say, no, you couldn't. You will never stop us from doing this to each other. That's what they say. So anyway, that is a problem with whatever prison reform we might have. But, you know, the other day on Facebook, some friend of a friend wrote down that when the guy, you know, what's the name of the guy in Kingston who drowned his family?
They're from Montreal.
Okay, so they said, I hope when he gets to prison, they mete out a little prison justice on him and kill him. And I was like, fuck off. You know, like, you want, that's how glib people are about people that go to prison, that they want to brutalize the prisoner who kills, like, oh, they'll do it for us because they just kill each other all the time. I mean, we that's what I'm saying about revenge. It's like, that is our system. It's basically revenge. Most people, while, you know, I said in my thing, until we start sending people away forever for whatever they do, most people would say they don't want that to be the system. But when you, but they also don't really want to do anything to stop that from being the system. So now I have an uncle by marriage who grew up horribly. And when he was 17, in some crazy thing, drunk, he killed a guy with a crossbow. Okay, so he went to prison for like 25 years. Then he started coming out. And every time he comes out, he starts panicking almost from the freedom, and then he reoffends. And last time I saw him was 2 years ago, just before my daughter was born. And, you know, he was in Ottawa, and he was doing real well. The guy has never committed a crime since that murder. He was doing real well, but he said, I just got a new parole officer, and he's a real hard ass. And then, like, 2 weeks later, I guess he went, like, somewhere, you know, it's like when he came to my wedding, he had to find, we lived downtown Toronto, he was staying with us, and on a Saturday, he had to find some guy in Scarborough and report to him. And he was in a panic because the guy wasn't in because it was Saturday. And he was like, they're going to come and arrest me and throw me in prison because I can't find the guy to report to. And people say, well, he committed murder. Fuck him. Like, that's... Mm-hmm. So, I feel like a guest here, so I didn't do it, but when the guy who was sitting in my place, that nice police guy from Prince Albert, said he's for that bill, I really just wanted to yell at him. Like, that's just such bullshit. That bill is just purely to appeal to the vengeful bone in everybody's body, including mine, like I say. Anyway.
Were there any particular things that were done for Gord when he was incarcerated to help him get better, learn some life skills?
No, I think that is exactly what he said. He was about 60 years old. He'd been in jail his whole life. He saw this guy killed in front of him, and he just was like, that's it. I can't do this anymore. And almost, you know, and he never went, I mean, when you know these people, you can't hope for them too much because really they just don't know how to live in this world. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't gone back to jail. That's all I can say. I met him 4 years ago. He had been out 2 years. He's been in the wind a few times. There's like 6 months at a time when nobody knows where Gord is. And sometimes, you know, the things he complains about are just like, oh, man, like so petty. But that's like they have no life skills. So, you know, I don't know. To me, it's a gigantic thing. It's like what people were saying, the culture. You know, no, it's like whatever. Nobody would ever get elected saying, you know, we should have restorative justice or something. Nobody would ever get elected, which we do actually have restorative justice programs here and there. But yeah, it's all like lock them up. It's not my problem. Oh, and you know what? I just wanted to say one more thing I learned, which probably you people don't know. So here's the one thing I learned most making the film. There's a thing, it's called the bucket, which basically that's where people go when they don't have parole. Like we think, oh, because we grow up, people commit a crime, they get on parole, they go home, and then when their trial comes up. But no, these guys, all the guys I know, if they commit a crime and they get arrested, they go to the bucket. So the bucket is, it's not even a jail yet. It's just like a room. It doesn't have any of the cool stuff that they have at prison. None of the, like, whatever, no TVs, no good food. It's just in the bucket. And they wait there for 2 years. As much as 2 years. And everyone that I've ever interviewed said, and then they get, you know, and then when they get sentenced and they go to jail, they're happy. Because nobody, the bucket time is the worst time. I had no idea about this. Like, I had no idea. You know, that's, anyway.
Anybody
I think I sucked
down?
All the air out of the room.
I just, if I may say something, you know, one of the things that I saw myself was that we do have in Canada, or at least we had at that time, and I guess it's one of those things that's under threat always, where you can go down from maximum to minimum, and you can get into these sort of halfway, these lighter prisons that seem a little bit more like suburban neighborhoods, if in your suburban neighborhood they came and counted you five times a day. But the critics, the criticism of this always is, this is like club fed, they would call it. They're being treated better than anybody else. But it seems to me it's at least the attempt to try to give these guys some sort of skill that might allow them to be outside. Did they talk about it?
Yeah, so here's another, I mean, I'm really kind of pissed that the cops who were here for the first thing didn't stay for this one because it's, I don't know, it's whatever. They came, they show their PowerPoint thing, and they friggin' leave. But that's the other thing I wanted to yell at the guy for, like, we have programs. You know, really, like, screw your programs. That, it's got, not, you know, definitely, if I was going to jail or my uncle was going to jail or you were going to jail, I would rather you go to Club Fed than Millhaven. But the problem is not the programs. The problem is that when they get out of jail, they have no, like, nobody needs love, our love and support more than people who get out of jail. And they, you know, of course nobody wants to give that to them. But I'm just saying, if you don't give that to them, if you make them feel like, you know, if they turn around, you know, my friend gave a cigarette to a woman who was a crack, known to the police as a crack user. So he, if you know Toronto, his halfway house is at Keel and Dundas, it's called Keel House. So he was at Keelan Dundas, and there was a woman there, and she's a known crack user. And she bummed a cigarette from him. The cops came by, asked to see his papers. He's a dangerous criminal. So they busted him for, associating with a known criminal. And they took him to the Don jail. And his parole officer came that day and said to him, "Keith, what's up?" And Keith said, "This is bullshit. Here's what happened." And the parole officer said, "Yes, you're right. This is bullshit. I'll get you out." He got him out 2 weeks later. 2 weeks, he was in the Don jail, where people are getting killed. You know, and like anybody, I'm going to guess, anybody here in this room, 2 weeks in the Don jail would be the worst fucking 2 weeks of your life. But it was just like, well, they said to him, "Well, your bed, as soon as he got arrested, his bed in the halfway house was taken away. So now we got nowhere to put you. So you got to stay here until we got to get you a bed." That's, to me, that's the why we have a recidivism rate that we have, because we're at, you know, nobody could, none of us could, you know, whatever, survive that amount of scrutiny. I want to make a joke about my wife there, but I won't.
A comment and a question, and the comment was, thank you, Alan. You shared your film with the BC Civil Liberties Association, and we screened it in Vancouver a while ago, and it was great. The question is, your first film was about vinyl collecting, awesome, fun, neat, and now, you know, you've done this film about prisons and our prison industrial complex, and is it possible for you to go back to vinyl, or has it changed you in a way that now, well, you know, your other projects are going to be
the sad answer to that, and that's like a fan filmmaking question, which I don't think is relevant here, but who knew that 17 years ago when I came to interview Professor Straw about his record collection, 17 years later I'd be here talking about something, well, a little less fun. Anyway, you know what? After I made this film, I really did feel like it changed my life, and I tried to get more films made on the subject. I tried to get a film made about solitary confinement. I tried to get a film made about... Well, actually, now, as it turns out, I know that John Kastner is now making a film about the problem of people going to jail who have really mental health things. I tried to do a lot of things, and everywhere I went, they just said, "Oh, that sounds like your last film." Which, you know, my reaction was, so what? But, like, so the answer is, I tried, but they wouldn't let me, or I couldn't get the funding for it. I am doing some little things with people I know, like, but no, I can't sustain a living making films on this subject. But I'm really grateful that I did make this film, I have to say.
I have one last question. There's this idea that people, you can't blame where you came from for horrible things that you do. And you were talking about uncovering the abuse and the sort of causal context that a lot of these men came from. Can you make that connection and be okay with it? I mean, it's like, it's the preventative versus the...
Well, I mean, one of the guys in my film that was in Mount Cashel. He's one of the guys that people consider one of the stars, and he has this sort of rant where he says that people say to him, "Well, Polly went to Mount Cashel and he didn't come out a criminal," and he's like, "Fuck Polly, I don't care about Polly." Like, so for me, it's like, yes, I'm glad there are, I mean, first of all, I believe that anybody who suffered the kind of thing Gordy did is going to show the mark of it on themselves the rest of their lives, maybe not through committing crime. I have to admit, I feel embarrassed that I never thought about this, but, you know, the reason, the reason they can do such horrible things to us and not consider us for a second is because they don't exist to themselves. Like, they, you know, that's the thing. They have no, there is no person there. They don't give a fuck about themselves. That's why they don't care about us, because they don't even know what caring about us or somebody would be. Nobody's ever cared about them. So, I mean, yeah, like, I, you know, which is not to say that I don't think they should be put in prison. I just think, you know, whatever, like I said, they're part of us. They're, you know, they're part of us, and anything we can do to get them back to us, we should do. That's what I think.
Unless anyone has another question. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Faisal. I'm a graduate here from the Faculty of Law, and I had, I guess, a broader question about film being used as a public policy tool and in this specific context. I mean, you spoke earlier about, you know, the revenge bone in each of our bodies. To what extent do you think film can be used as a message to temper that bone? You know, for some people, coming to school and learning public policy is a way to communicate things. Other people learn through other methods. And do you think people's response to your films show that film can be an effective public policy tool to either educate people on you know, the alternatives to violence, the alternatives to prison in this case? Or do you think it's too passive of a tool to be used?
No, I think it's... Well, all I can say is, you know, I feel like the people who've seen my film have been changed. I don't know if they've been changed enough, but they were changed. I mean, it's almost embarrassing, but, you know, the night my film premiered, everybody in my cast was there, 7 people. And when the film was over, they got a 10-minute standing ovation, which was weird in a certain way, given the subject of the film. But I attribute it to the fact that in that 90 minutes, people kind of thought about something they never thought about before. And it kind of shocked them. And so, yeah, I mean, I said in my introduction, that, you know, whatever. Like, these are people we don't hear from, and we hear them in very, very, very circumspect things and a little sound bites, and, you know, we just never get to know them. I think, basically, if everybody like me had an uncle who was in prison, we'd have a different policy. I really believe that. I think that it's because they're so completely walked away from us, and all we ever see them in is like, yeah, like horrible American prison reality shows, like, you know. Yeah, so yes, I mean, yeah, I'm not that naive, but I think that films can change, but whether they, but on the other hand, my films are shown on TV Ontario, like, those people already aren't voting for, you know, the Conservatives, so.
But I do think that, I mean, if I can answer that question a little bit, is I do think you can have a situation in which what Alan is saying is that if you can show people who you only see as categories, murderers, criminals, whatever, if you can actually, they become Gord or they become somebody, I think it does have the potential for people to at least to humanize people. The last film I just completed was about Somali immigrants in different countries. So these are black people, they're Muslim people, very often characterized in ways of that have been very negative ways. And you get to see them and you get to realize that they are quite a bit more ordinary than people will think about them in such large and negative categories. You say, does that change people? You hope it does. It certainly changes
I think, as Alan says, when you are actually meeting, you're spending time and meeting people like that, it changes you, and you hope that the film can perform that to a certain degree. Would you say?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've always tried to make films where you feel like you're actually meeting the person to as good much a degree as you can, which is why, whatever. Two, that's the good and the bad thing about the films. But yes, I feel, you know what I mean. There's a guy in my film, Art. He's kind of famous in Toronto. Not famous, but a lot of people have seen him because he panhandles at the Castle Frank station. There's scenes of him in the film panhandling there. Now he's had his leg amputated, but he's still panhandling there. But anyway, hundreds of people have gone up to him since the film was finished and talked to him and given him money. But the thing about, you know, and I might have shown him, it's just that he speaks, he's got his teeth are knocked out. I was just afraid you wouldn't be able to understand him here. But he's a scary-looking guy, very, very scary-looking guy. And everybody who's seen the film is now not scared of him because they see that he's a very, very sweet, articulate, extremely broken man who we broke. And, yeah, I feel like everybody who's seen the film now, they talk to him like he's a star. But they also talk to him like he's a human being, which people generally haven't. So, I don't know.
Another question here.
I'd like to ask a question to both of you. We've talked a lot, and your films talk a lot, about what has happened to people in different systems of incarceration. I'd like to ask about rehabilitation and what either or both of you think. Is there a way, Alan, you were talking about the jail culture and killing inmates or inmates being killed by inmates. Is there any way that these damaged people, because they really are damaged, most of them, can be rehabilitated, so either through skills that Jim was talking about, or John was talking about, or through, I don't know, whether it's psychology or whatever the hell it is, because this is Canada, we are a much more fair-minded society than many. Is there a way to get these folks back into society so they're not going to be recidivists?
Okay, well, here's my answer. I think that what we do for rehabilitation and teaching them skills and do programs doesn't hurt. But I think the only way they get rehabilitated is when they themselves decide, I'm not going back to prison, which they do. So then at that point that they make that decision, and we see that they've made that decision, I think when they're out of prison, that's when all our forces should be marshaled to help them stay out. But I don't think much of what happens in prison does that much for them, because they're still in prison. It's like, you know, it's prison. Like, they have to be that person while they're in prison. So, yes, there's seven people in my film, a couple of them have died, but nobody else has gone back to prison because they decided, I've had enough of this.
I would say my feeling about it is that, as I said earlier, it seems to me that prison itself is a pretty noxious place to be, and that the longer you're in prison, the less likely you're ever going to be able to function outside of that prison. I think your man Gord sort of says, like, I was good at doing this, you know, you get good at it. You know, if you spend enough time on the orthopedic ward of a hospital, it's hard to go outside into another world, or in the army, or in almost any sort of institution. And this sort of institution, where everything is completely regulated, is very addictive for people. So it seems to me that the alternate systems is not so much what they teach you in prison, although that can help if you actually come out with a skill and can get a job and try to make a straight life of it. But it seems more like the less time, that there are alternative ways of dealing with people than putting them in these institutions that are so difficult to shake once you're part of that world and that system. And that seems to be what a good deal of the rest of at least the developed world has come around to believing.
Yeah, I mean, Art, my Castle Frank guy, said directly to me, he doesn't know what the hell to do out here. Like, here, he's scared every day. In prison, he was, you know, scared, but he knew how to do it. Like, he knew these are the rules, and you don't do this, and you don't do that, and you'll get out of this. Here, like, you know, when we have that meal, he has to eat with his back to the wall, because so nobody's coming back over, you know, from behind. Like, that's so, yeah, we have to, like, love them out here, like, big time. And if we do, I think they'll, most of them will stay out. Most of them, you know, I don't know what the real statistics are, but I'd be willing to bet that recidivism is mostly petty crimes and breaking parole. I mean, there is a famous case, and again, not John Kastner made a film, where a guy asked to be let back into prison. You know, he showed up at the door, knocking at the door, let me back, and he had to, like, punch a cop to get arrested to go back to prison because that's what he knew. Out here, it was too, you know. And also, the thing is, if you think that any day now you're going back, why not go back today? So that's a lot of it, too.
And one of the things is that in places like Finland and in a number of other places, they try to get not only have short sentences, but almost everybody, anybody who's not a violent offender, and that includes, I mean, like a continually violent offender, which can include people who have committed murder, they start letting you go out fairly early on in your sentence for a weekend. So it's trying to break down a little bit of this completely separate world where you're in this other reality, whether you're in a prison with all the rules and the violence of prison. The first job I ever had after university was working in a hospital in New York that had prisons within it. And my first reaction to the whole thing was, I didn't know this was here. I never thought, well, if they shoot you and arrest you, they're going to put you in jail and in a hospital, and that there were six prisons in Bellevue Hospital in New York City. It's mostly, and I think it's the first thing you said in your thing, this is a hidden world. It's a world that, in a country like this country, which has a fairly low crime rate and a fairly safe environment, these are the most lawless places in our world. This is a place where this guy can just say, well, this guy, and we didn't even know why, this guy just got strangled and killed for owing a debt, no doubt, or...
Well, a guy got killed at the Don for not giving back a hairbrush.
Okay. So these are the most violent, lawless places in our entire society, and this is where we put people for 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and then we let them out. And that's, you know, then you have bred a truly dangerous person, or a difficult, broken person at the very best. So something in that is really a flawed approach. So all of these things where you give people longer and longer sentences, I think go to the heart of the question of, like, how do you make a society safer? And it doesn't seem that that's the way you do it.
I mean, I just want to say, like, John said something about 15 minutes or something, how people, that's got nothing to, like, it's got nothing to do with it. They don't care. They're not thinking about, oh, if I do this, I'm going to prison. They're thinking, I don't give a fuck about anything. Like, I don't care about anything. Not, I don't care if I'm going to prison. Like, I'm in pain, and you're going to pay, and then I'll go to prison. You know?
Any question?
Thank you both for your films. My question is, how do we, all of us, collectively, try and help one another be educated in this way? I mean, I can't imagine anyone watching either of your documentaries and not having a different view. So I'm in the education field, and I specialize in fostering behavioral shifts, but I'm talking around service. And I do have some knowledge of this topic, or I wouldn't be here. I've also been to Dismas, so.
Oh.
But I
I just wonder if you have, either of you have any recommendations in how to get this out there. Like, it's wonderful to say, I would really like to see this played on other stations than PBS and TVO. I'm really aware of, as Barney Frank says, the two medias in the left and the right watching exclusively MSNBC and New York Times and Fox News over here. How do we, anything that you can tell us to, how to
well,
get
again,
this
we're
out
just
there?
Filmmakers, you know. So now I'll just go to my personal opinion, which is, I don't know, I just think that we let vengeful people get away with being vengeful because we can sort of relate to their vengefulness. That's basically what I think. I mean, I just think, I don't know, I didn't hear a lot of, you know, like the most, there was a great piece by Conrad Black, actually, about this new bill. That was one of the best things I read, the bill that just passed. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is I think that this happened because we let it happen because we didn't make a big deal out of it because, I don't know, they appeal to their base and we're sort of part of that base. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. But
I think I would just say what I said before is there's some sort of what passes for common sense. It seems that if you pass these bills and you make things tougher and you do all of this, it's going to deter crime and bring the crime rate down. The truth of the matter is it doesn't seem to do it and that there is no backing for it. And what was the famous comment in this government said, you know, even though somebody said you're passing this stuff and the crime rate is going down, I said, well, there's the unreported crime. Well, if you can get away with saying that, you know, that the invisible crime is, or the unreported crime is the one we're going to base this on. I don't know exactly how to do it except that if you can come around, if you can somehow spread even personally, whether it's yelling at somebody who says this at a party or somewhere, you know, that this is just, it's wrong. It's wrong-headed to think these things, that this is not making it safer, it's making it less safe. But, you know, I don't know how you spread that in a larger sense. It seems clear to me that since I made my film 8 years ago and they were talking about implementing what they are implementing today, that it's, you know, it's an ideological stand. It's a stand based on some firm belief. And it is a belief in vengeance, actually. And I think we're probably, I'm interested that Alan uses the word as much as he is doing, because I think that's something, at least in this country, we're not actually comfortable with. We don't like to think that by doing this we're being vengeful. We like to think we're being, you know, fair to the victims or whatever. The vengeance part, I mean.
Well, I mean, I sort of tried to fall on my sword here. Like yesterday I was sitting in my car, and the CBC reporter was talking about this woman, McClintic, who was she's testifying at the Tory Stafford thing, and she was telling what she did and what this Michael Rafferty did to this 15-year-old girl. And every bit of my sympathy for Gordon and everybody I know went out the window, and I just, like, murderous rage. And then they said, in a kind of yada-da-da-da-da way, the reporter said, yeah, and of course she told some stories about how she was sexually abused, and it was all kind of like, who gives a damn because you did this to this little girl? So, I mean, I guess I think, you know, it's like we all have our point at which we'll be Stephen Harper too, in a way, so that's part of the problem. But I think the biggest problem is people still have this idea that the guy stood outside the liquor store and thought, if I kill this guy, like, that's wrong, and I might go to jail for a long time, so maybe I shouldn't do it, but on the other hand, maybe I'll get away with it. And then he doesn't get away with it, and we say, see, now we're going to punish you. And it's like, that never happens. He doesn't sit there and he's a completely broken person who doesn't know what the hell he's doing, and he's probably completely drunk, and he probably has had the worst childhood you could ever imagine, and that's why he does it. And jail has nothing to do with it. Jail is just this thing we do because it makes us feel better or something. It's got nothing to do with him. It's not a deterrent at all. You know, that's what I think. It's not at all. It's a deterrent to me. That's why I don't do it.
Right?
But I wouldn't do it. Yeah. I'm scared of getting caught and going to prison because I'm scared of prison.
This is what the Tony Duvitt.
Glimpses in your film of Jim. We saw glimpses of like the warden, the prison guard. You mentioned the hospital worker, the psychologist, the person running the programs. If you filled this room, emptied us out, and filled it with the wardens, the prison guards, you know, the people who run the programs, I wonder if you could tell me what their reaction would be. And what I'm saying is that there is the exception, of course, among all of them, of a moment of compassion, humanity, kind-heartedness. But is it possible that all this system is just self-fulfilling, that change can't come from within?
But it doesn't seem like it's going to come in from the prison system, the change. I think, I don't know how you feel, but I remember when my first job, when I worked in this prison in New York, and we got the lecture from the warden about how we were supposed to act, and we were sort of smart-ass young kids in our 20s, and somebody sort of giggled a little bit at something, and he just pulled out this big case of homemade weapons that they had found in this, that they had rounded up that week or whatever in the prison, and he started to show, and he started to talk about prisoners as if they were actually another species, and told us how they could, like, bend metal, and it was very striking. So I think if you speak to people within the system, with all the possible exceptions, they have often cast people who are in as inmates as if they really are a separate species of people, and almost in the way that people regarded slaves as just, they weren't like us. So I don't know actually what change will come from within that system.
Yeah, I mean, I have friends who have prison guards. I'm sure there's some nice prison guards, but the thing about prison guards is that's just their job, and it's kind of an us and them situation, and their job is just to move these guys through the system, and they don't really care about anything else. And my friend was teaching people at the Don Jail, and every time she showed up to teach the course, they had to go and get the guys out of their cell and bring them to her class, which was a big fucking drag to them, so they keyed her car and she quit, you know, and that's it. Like, they don't, I mean, they're not bad. They're probably mostly stupid, but they're not bad. They're just, that's not their job to rehabilitate. Their job is to go get the guy from the cell, and if they can have a smoke, instead of getting the guy from the cell, they're going to have a smoke. That's what I think.
I'd like to thank both our guests, John Kalina and Alan Zweig. Thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank the three people whose work I admire very much. We now have a reception in the main lobby there. Also to remind you that tomorrow things begin at 9 o'clock. We have a very exciting day. We have the federal and provincial ministers of justice. We have a very interesting panel on sentencing and imprisonment, a big wrap-up panel, so I hope to see you all there.